Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. You probably know that the Bulldog basketball team plays Hawaii tonight, so I am on the islands. But before I left, I had the great privilege of spending some time with a real legend in the world of track and field and cross country. You know that I love talking about World War II veterans, and I love sports. And this week's show kind of blends the two, because the gentleman who you'll hear from today has been involved with Olympic teams, with NCAA championship teams. He's in town this weekend for the Run for the Dream meet at the Save Mart Center, which I hope you're on your way to right now, or maybe coming home from right now, or maybe you're in the arena listening to us right now. But we are going to hear for the next hour from George Dales, who hails from the cradle of coaches, Miami University of Ohio. You've heard of the cradle of coaches, probably some of the legendary coaches that came out of that university in Oxford, Ohio. We're talking about guys like Woody Hayes, Bo Schembechler, Paul Brown, Weeb Eubank. The list goes on. And it also includes George Dales, who, if you are involved in cross country or track and field, you've probably heard his name thrown around a few times. His name is on an award that goes to the best cross-country coach in the country year in, year out, and he is a legend in that business. So we're going to hear from him today, not just about his coaching career, but about his unique role in the Allied effort in World War II. So we welcome George Dale to the program. And George, how old are you now?
88 and feeling great.
That was 88 and feeling great?
Yes, sir.
Now, what are you going to say when you're 89?
Well, I'm looking forward. I hope I make it to 100.
You're going to have to change the 88 and feeling great to 89 and feeling fine?
Exactly.
All right. Now, let's go back a few years. You grew up in Cleveland, Ohio?
Yes, sir.
Now, when Pearl Harbor happened, were you in school then at Miami of Ohio at the time?
Yes, I was.
What do you remember about that Sunday morning?
Well, we kind of knew that there was going to be a war. I think the U.S. knew, because there was already preparations. You could see that building up and getting the draft going and so on. We anticipated, and here I was a senior in college, and we were worried, of course, whether we were going to be able to graduate before we go into the military.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a preferred branch of service that you had entertained in your mind?
Yes, I was very fortunate. I happened to be the top physical education student in the department at the time. I was in the honor roll, and I had the highest physical fitness test. And so they selected me, the PE department selected me to teach fitness to the Navy V-5 pre-flight school students that Navy sent to Miami, because the airport in Hamilton was close by. So that was my job, getting up in the morning at 5 o'clock and giving exercises to the pre-flight pilots.
That day on December 7th, 1941, when you heard the news about Pearl Harbor, did it kind of clear up in your mind that you probably would have to contribute in some way to the military effort?
Oh, yes, and I always preferred the Navy.
And so you get this job of training people. You talked about your own athleticism. Now, how many different things were you doing athletically at the time? I know you were pole vaulting, right?
Yes, but originally I was a gymnast. I came through the German Turnverein system in Cleveland, Ohio, where we did all the German gymnastics, and and starting in junior high, I started pole vaulting, because in those days with the bamboo pole, we would really love jumping over fences and over bushes, so I became a pole vaulter.
Sounds like fun to me. We're talking to George Dales, the former track coach at Western Michigan, a Hall of Famer in that field, and a veteran of World War II, who's going to tell us what he did during that time. And I want to take a little side route here as you talk about pole vaulting, because this is the time, 1941, 1942, where the best pole vaulter in the world and the only guy to clear 15 feet on one of those bamboo poles was right here in the Central Valley in Dutch Warmerdam. Was he a guy who you looked up to at the time or were familiar with?
Very much so. We had a loop film of him, and that was, we would just keep looking over and over again. And the nice thing about it is I did meet Dutch after the war, and I roomed with him at track when we had track championships. So I'm very, very fond. And one reason I came here to see the Dutch Warmerdam track and the statue and so on, because I heard so much about it.
Well, and you say you had that loop film of him pole vaulting. Did you ever pick anything up? Would you looked at it with a fine-tooth comb, I'm sure, to figure out how he does it, right?
Definitely. We modeled all our jumping because of that one film of Dutch Warmerdam. Yes, sir. Only we weren't quite as tall as he was.
Yeah, that was an advantage for him. And just while we're on that topic, I don't want to spend too much time talking about somebody else, but I'm sure over the years, as you've seen track and field grow and you've seen the technological advances and seen guys like Sergei Bubka go 20 feet, you ever sit there and say, you know, if Dutch Warmerdam had these poles, he'd hit this certain height? Have you ever contemplated that?
Well, it was a completely change of technique because they went from the bamboo pole to the stiff poles, you know. We went to the steel pole and the Swedish steel pole and the American steel pole. And that completely changed the technique. And just as much as anything else, it was the pits. Because now you can land any part of your body and not be concerned about getting hurt. But in the old days, you had to land on your feet or else you were done.
I did have a chance before he died to interview Dutch Warmerdam once. And that's exactly what he told me. He said, getting up was easy. Getting down was the hard part without hurting yourself, as you knew yourself at the time as a pole vaulter. So the Navy gives you this job of training these recruits. What kinds of things would you do? Were you tough on them? Did you have that drill sergeant mentality, or did you go a little easier?
Oh, no, definitely. But fortunately, when going through physical education at Miami, we did have marching drills, we did have calisthenic drills, and so on and so forth, the old German system of gymnastics. And we had a very, very good background in leadership and leading exercises and marching exercises. So it was very easy to go into that very, very easily into the Navy.
And so tell me about that transition from still on campus at Miami to where the Navy sent you next.
Of course, we had to go to boot camp, and I went to Great Lakes Naval Training Station, where we spent, I think, 8 weeks or so. And just that was mostly orientation, getting your shots and getting all the interviews, you know, all kinds of screening. And from then on, people would get assigned to what area they were interviewed and sent to. But I was already pretty much earmarked ahead of time because at the time, the Navy was looking for physical instructors for physical training, especially for the boot camps. And Gene Tunney, the famous boxer, world championship boxer, was in charge of the fitness programs. There were two fitness programs. One was the Gene Tunney program. They called us the Tunney Fish. And there was the Tom Hamilton program, who dealt with the Air Force, Navy Air Force group. So they were divided into groups. I had the good fortune, because I was working for the Navy while I was in college, that I went in with the Tunney program. And then from Great Lakes, we were sent to Bainbridge, Maryland, where the Navy Physical Education School is.
And, well, I want to ask you before you get there, not to interrupt, but there were some other guys at Great Lakes at the time who are names that people in our audience might recognize.
Yes, Paul Brown, a man from the Cleveland Browns, and Weeb Eubank from the Colts. Well, Weeb Eubanks was my supervising teacher at Miami when I was a senior at and I did my student teaching at the McGuffey High School, and Weeb Eubanks was the football coach and the athletic director. So I had known them, and, of course, many of the top football players got into the Navy, and every time somebody like that appeared there, they got on the Great Lakes football team, which was the outstanding team in the country at the time.
With so many colleges decimated, not just in their player ranks, but their coaching ranks as well, by the draft and the war going on, Great Lakes probably could have beaten just about anybody, huh?
They did.
And they did. And I imagine, it seems pretty clear that at the time you had no idea what those two gentlemen you mentioned, Weeb Eubank and Paul Brown, would be destined for down the road.
No, that's correct. But I did meet them at Great Lakes.
Was it fun to watch what they achieved down the road?
Oh, definitely. And when we went through boot camp, I went through, there must have been at least a half dozen football players from different colleges, even the pros. The pros were just beginning then, but there were top people, and some people who had already been in the Navy before still had to go through the boot camp experience.
And, of course, Eubank is famous for winning the Super Bowl with Joe Namath. I don't know if Joe Namath would have hacked it all right in one of your boot camps, though. What do you think?
Well, it was a different time. you just, anybody told you what to do, and you just said how far and how fast you had to go. It was, everybody was deeply concerned. They were just ready to go.
Everyone was in it for the same reason.
You bet.
Knew what you were fighting
you
for.
You bet.
Yeah, so you did, and I cut you off. You were shifted out to Maryland, and pick up the story from there if you can.
Well, we had the regular training for physical instructors and what you needed to do to drill and get physically fit, the recruits that were coming in. And I'll tell you, some of them were very, very unfit and had to start from scratch. That's what the Navy did, and fortunately, I met a fellow by the name of Adolf Kiefer, who was in charge of the Navy water safety program. And Adolf Kiefer was a Olympic champion when he was in high school in Illinois, backstroker in 1936 Berlin Olympics. So those were the caliber type of people that were in the Navy at the time. Mm-hmm. So I met Adolf then and have been friends with him ever since. Then from the physical training school, we had a list of assignments, people were at the top of the list had pretty much a choice of where they could go. Well, Grove City College was available. I was hoping I'd get back to Miami, but Grove City College had an opening, and they sent me there. Grove City College was a women's college in Pennsylvania, and they were training the communication Navy people. Mm-hmm. So I was in charge of their physical fitness and recreation program. We had a set up recreation program there too.
Well, that doesn't sound like a bad job. Makes for pretty good odds.
Well, it wasn't, but that's not what you join the Navy when you're 21 years old, you know, 20, 21 years old. I said, geez, I want to join the Navy to see the world, you know.
Not Grove City College.
No, seriously. So I requested sea duty. And I was sent to Pennsylvania, to the Pennsylvania Navy Yard, where there was a brand new ship being built, the USS Alaska CB-1, cruiser battleships. And those kind of ships were actually patterned after the German pocket battleships, the Bismarck and the Scharnhorst. They were fast and a lot of gunpowder. So I was assigned right from the start as they were creating the crew of 2,400 sailors. At the Philadelphia Navy Yard. So I was there for a while until the ship got finished and got built.
All right, and I think that's a good place for us to break. We'll pick back up there at the Philadelphia Navy Yard when we come back with George Dales, a Hall of Fame coach in track and field and cross country, and our guest today here on Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Anchors away. My guest today, George Dales, has heard that a few times. He served in the U.S. Navy during World War II. Since then, he's become a legendary coach in cross country and track and field, won the NCAA cross country championships with Western Michigan, the Broncos, in 1964 and 1965. He's the big cheese in Kalamazoo. With apologies to Derek Jeter, I suppose. And he is here in the Valley this week. In fact, right now, you can go catch him at the Save Mart Center. The Run for the Dream meet is in full force already. That's going to last until 9:30 tonight at the Save Mart Center. It is such a great event, celebrating the tradition of track and field, bringing generations together, promoting fitness. And Bob Fraley does such a wonderful job with that year in, year out. And he's brought some big names in over the years, too. This year, George Dales is one of those big names. But back in 1942, 43, you weren't such a big name yet. You were the guy who was probably looking up at a few of those recruits and talking down to them.
Yes, the one great privilege and honor that I did have, I was the youngest chief petty officer in the Navy at the time.
That's impressive. And you told us before we broke that you were in Philadelphia with the crew of the USS Alaska. You said there are 2,400 men on that boat, on that ship.
Yes.
And were you in charge of 2,400 men's physical fitness, just you by yourself?
Exactly.
That sounds like a big responsibility.
Yes, and especially since in preparation, remember that in the Navy, when you're at sea, it's four on, four off on hours. And there's time in between, and we had to not only have fitness, but we had to do recreation activities also. We did boxing because Gene Tunney boxing was probably the most important activity.
And I'm guessing you never ran into Gene Tunney and challenged him to a fight.
No, absolutely not. But the interesting thing is that once we had a shakedown cruise going to Guantanamo, where we prepared all the guns and so on, and then went through the Panama Canal on the West Coast, and then to Hawaii. And that's when Admiral Nimitz came on board ship to check out our ship and see if we were fit to be ready to go to the Pacific.
Well, he was checking the fitness of the ship or the fitness of the crew?
Both. Also, the first thing that the top man would do is he'd head directly to the mess to see what kind of bean soup they had. And that's a Navy tradition, U.S. Navy tradition. The first thing you check is the food and the food service, and it's always Navy bean soup.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I never knew that before. You learn something every day. And, you know, most weeks on this program, we're hearing from World War II veterans about battles at sea, on land, in the air, or whatever. And I'm real interested. We haven't spent too much time talking about that time between battles. And it seems like you have a lot of information to share with that regard. What was it like when you're talking about four on, four off, and instituting these different programs for their fitness and their recreation? Give us a sense of a typical cycle of that from your perspective.
Well, we first had to get up in the morning and exercise, of course, mostly calisthenics. There's not much else you could do. We would do some running along and around the ship, which was 808 feet long, so there was lots of running space.
And I'm sure there were never any accidents when that happened. Nobody ever tripped or ran into something they weren't supposed to.
Not really. Because we had shifts. You see, there were four different shifts, usually. And, of course, that was also you had to have gunnery practice all the time.
Right.
But there was free time in between. After you get off duty, you go into your bunk, you sleep for 4 hours, then you have 4 hours of you're free, and then you go on duty again. So we had round-the-clock shifts doing different things in preparation.
What did you find among the crew a lot of competition when you would take on one particular athletic skill or another, that these guys were pretty competitive with each other?
Well, before we got into the Pacific, and even during the Pacific, we always had some free time because we'd go into the battle zone but then retreat to get fuel and food and so on. We were at sea almost 2 years without going ashore. Mm. But and this was between the Philippines, Battle of the Philippines, and then Iwo Jima and then Okinawa. But we would have recreation times. We would fall back, and there was a place called Magmag, the island of Magmag in the Ulithi chain. That was the main supply base where leading up to the different battles. So with some of the sailors, we had them going ashore. We played baseball mostly. And, of course, did many. We had boxing matches all the time. I had 64 basketball teams because the USS Alaska, amidships, there's a flight deck. We mm-hmm. had planes, these planes with that are on pontoons shooting off from the catapults. But we put nets around, and we had basketball games. We had fierce basketball games, especially the Marines against the officers.
I could see how that rivalry would develop. And you know, I've talked to so many veterans who served in the Navy, and every one of them ran into rough seas, if not a typhoon, along the way in the Pacific. How do you play basketball when the ship is rolling back and forth?
Well, we really don't, and the typhoons were really, really bad. The one that right toward the end of the war, I hate to say it, but Admiral Halsey led us right into it.
Well, that's why they call it Halsey's Typhoon.
Yes.
Yeah.
You ought to read the book.
Yeah.
It was so bad, of course, a couple of destroyers went under. The whole bow of the Pittsburgh got sheared off, and the Hornet, the aircraft carrier Hornet, the whole front flight deck just rolled up down into the water, and that's how badly the typhoon was.
And you were in that fleet for that typhoon?
Yes.
How was that experience for your ship? How badly were you thrown about?
I was seasick all the time, and I still have vertigo. But you get used to it. Big ships were not as bad as the smaller ships, the
right.
Tin cans, the destroyer escorts especially.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to pick up sailors, you know, we're in the sea. The funny thing is that we also try to pick up Japanese pilots, but they wouldn't come on board because that they said that there are too many Japanese submarines around. They didn't want to come aboard on an American ship because we would be going down.
Oh, wow. I'm not surprised by that one bit. So you're on the ship through all of this time, and this is a long period. You said he never made land. And these are some pretty intense battles that you're kind of mentioning on the sidelines here. Now, how was that from your perspective? I understand you stayed on ship while these guys would go ashore and come back, but I'm sure along this time you're developing relationships with these young men who you're training and trying to keep in shape. And they come back, and not only are they not in shape, some of them are not alive anymore. How was that for you to watch that human toll of war?
Well, the worst thing is that we were almost next to the Franklin. That's the carrier that really, really got beat up bad. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to take on some of those injured and so on. That was a worst time because we had to take them on and put them down in our sick bay and take care of them. That's when it really, really struck hard. During battle, I mean, you did your duty. And that was it, and you weren't concerned of what was happening. There were over 2,000 kamikaze planes and carrier fleet 64 and the battleship 5th Fleet. They were alternating. We were with the battleships with the 5th Fleet when we were bombarding, and we were with the carriers when they were flying over the Iwo Jima and Okinawa primarily.
Mm-hmm. Was it difficult? Just as you're still a young man. I mean, it's not like you're 40, 50, 60 years old. You've seen all these things before. When you saw the results of what happened on those islands, when the guys would come back on ship, what did that do to you just emotionally?
Actually, we kind of expected it.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of routine. And you didn't know when you're going to be next.
Right.
So everybody just did their job, believe me, and looked forward to doing their job because we were going to getting ready to invade Japan.
Yeah, and I know I've talked to so many veterans who are so thankful they didn't have to make that invasion of Japan. You probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to me. But you mentioned that when a battle's on, everyone just does their part. And that was another question I had for you. Your role on this ship obviously is to train all these young men, but when general quarter sounds, when you go to your battle stations, did you have another role? Was there a duty that you were supposed to man while the battle was raging?
Yes, I was on the aft deck at the back of the rear end of the ship and on quad 44 millimeter guns.
Uh-huh.
I was a gun crew chief there, and two sets of four quad millimeter guns, and they were anti-aircraft guns. Our biggest duty, number one, duty of the USS Alaska and the USS Guam, the only two CBs, cruiser battleships, U.S. ever built.
Mm-hmm.
Their primary duty was to protect carriers because we had a lot of guns. We had 9 12-inch guns, which traveled almost 30 miles, and that was when we were bombarding. But our main job was to have a lot of anti-aircraft around those aircraft carriers.
So when general quarter sounded, you would go take that post
station,
on
yes.
that gun,
yes,
and look for incoming aircraft that you
yes,
could fire
yes.
upon.
Well, the 64, the flight, aircraft carriers. At one time, I think we had 8 or 10 aircraft carriers that we had to protect, and we counted over the time between Iwo Jima and Okinawa over 2,000 kamikaze planes coming down toward that fleet. Now, there's a large number of ships in the fleet, you know,
mm-hmm.
Including destroyers and destroyer escorts and even submarines. So, and they covered a large area in the Pacific Ocean so they could maneuver.
And because of your standing in that fleet, your ship might not necessarily have been the number one target of the kamikazes, but you had to shoot them down so they wouldn't hit the carriers.
The first target was the carrier because mm-hmm. I knew that that they would be going in. We didn't have too many planes. It was Doolittle's crew that had gone into Japan previously, but we were too far away from Japan. So the aircraft carriers were doing most of the damage. And I say if there were any real heroes in the Navy, you would see hundreds of planes coming off of these carriers, about 10 carriers, about 100 planes each, 1,000 planes up in the air, going into Japan, and then coming back all busted up and crumbling, and you didn't know how many were going to come back. I say that, to me, that has stayed with me the rest of my life, just to watching the great heroes in the Navy Air Force.
Never knowing whether it's going to be a suicide mission or not on a lot of those.
But anyway, the carriers were the first. But then eventually the Japanese got smart, and they decided to go after about 30 miles away. There were always, we'd call them picket ships. They would pick up on radar and warn us. So one thing we always had in the Navy, they had cracked the Japanese code, and we always knew when there's going to be an attack. And the Navy information officers in Hawaii really did a terrific job because we knew what was coming and getting ready. But the Japanese got smart and they started knocking off these picket ships because if we didn't get the information from the picket ships, all these planes would be coming at us. We wouldn't know until about 10 or 15 minutes or even less that there would be Japanese planes attacking the carriers.
Absolutely. Well, I want to ask you more about what it was like on that gun, but we need to take another break here. Yeah. We'll do that and come back with more stories from George Dales. He may be 88 years old, but you can tell how sharp his memory is, and I wouldn't challenge him to a pole vaulting duel either. We'll be back with the rest of Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Yes, I'm in Hawaii for Bulldog basketball tonight against the Rainbow Warriors, and there's plenty of World War II history here on the islands with the Arizona Memorial, the Pacific Aviation Museum. But back in Fresno today, I hope that you are taking the opportunity to celebrate the proud tradition of track and field in the Valley and head on out to the Save Mart Center for the Run for the Dream track meet. Competitors of all ages going head-to-head today. And speaking of all ages, 88-year-old George Dales is there. I got a chance earlier in the week to sit down and record this program with him. He is a legend in the track and field business, a national championship coach, a Hall of Fame coach. He's been part of several Olympic teams, and I might ask you about some Olympic memories as well. We could fill a whole program talking about track and field and cross-country. But let's continue on. A few years before that, still in World War II, and you mentioned in addition to being the fitness instructor for a ship full of Navy men, of sailors and seamen, you were, in times of battle, obligated to man a gun on the ship and fire at aircraft. Now, give me a sense for what that was like. Were you seeing a fairly steady stream of incoming aircraft? Were you sitting and waiting for something to fire at? What was your typical battle experience like, if there can be a typical in that situation?
Well, there was nothing real typical. The Japanese were very smart. They would come in very low, for one thing, and our guns could not be lowered to that degree, and they would come in between ships. So if you were to fire at them, you're also firing at your own ships. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the tactics, which was very smart. The other is they would hide up in the clouds or up in the sun, and a plane would come down as a kamikaze dive bomber, and everybody would be focusing on that one, but here's another plane coming out away from them and behind them, and that's the plane that was doing the damage. The first one would be shot down. The second one would pretty much make the target.
And that sounds like something where the more battle experience you have, the more on to those kind of tricks you would get.
Exactly, exactly. There were many that came by between our ships that we couldn't fire.
Otherwise, you're going to hurt the other
ship.
But
they would make us aim at them, but we couldn't fire while the others were getting ready to dive bomb.
Gotcha. Now, I'm curious, are there any specific moments in those kind of experiences that stand out for you, maybe a time where you actually hit a plane or you saw something that is really just etched in your memory?
Well, etched in my memory is the sky was just black with gun smoke, where especially from 5-inch guns, they would put out a big powder, and even to the point where you can't even see the plane you're shooting at, because there are so many with ships like the Alaska and the Guam with so much firepower, and everybody's shooting up there. Man, that sky is just full of explosive shells. That stands out. And as I say, the one that I can always remember, the plane just coming right next to you, but you couldn't fire because you'd be firing and hitting the ship that's on the other side.
And when you say right next to you, close enough to see the pilot's face?
Oh, yes, that close.
You could have fired a javelin at him, maybe.
Yeah, I wish.
We
needed rifles.
Yeah, that would have been right up your alley. Mm-hmm. And I'm also curious, as you describe this, I know it just had to be a very intense time when any of those battles would rise up like that. It occurs to me that maybe the feeling, and I don't know necessarily if this is always clear, when the battle ends, but that feeling when you know, okay, it's over, at least for now, we can breathe a little bit. Describe for me what that felt like to you.
Well, of course, when we weren't in the area where there was a lot of the kamikaze planes coming at us, we would also go off and bombard different islands because we had these big 12-inch guns. What I remember about that the most is I had the upper deck. I was with the top sergeant in the Marine Corps. He and I were bunk mates.
All right.
And he had the lower bunk, and I had the upper bunk. And the guns would be going on 24 hours, and especially at night, you know. They'd just keep going, boom, boom, boom. And then all of a sudden they stop. I wake up and fell out of my bed because you're so used to the constant bombarding.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that sticks out in my mind. You mentioned the Arizona, and that really sticks out in my mind because we anchored right when we got into the Hawaii, we anchored right next to the Arizona. It was sunk, of course, and bodies were still floating by. And that you could just every once in a while a body would come up from one of the ships.
And how long after December 7th was that? We talking months still?
Yeah, almost a year, believe me.
Wow.
Almost a year. And bodies would come up to the surface and float by. And there was quite a tide. You can see them just come floating. And that was the first feeling of you're going to war.
Oh, I can imagine how that would do that to you. And of course, it's so easy for us to forget there are still bodies down there.
You bet.
And if you have a chance to visit that Arizona Memorial, you can still see the teardrops of oil leaking from the ship there in Pearl Harbor. You mentioned a couple battles that I think are instantly recognizable for anybody who knows anything about World War II. You mentioned Iwo Jima and Okinawa. Now, at the time, and you just mentioned you bunked with a Marine Corps sergeant, the Marine Corps paid such a heavy price on Iwo Jima. Is that something that was visible and evident to you guys at the time? Tell me what, if at all, you remember about Iwo Jima as a whole, and if you had a sense for its greater significance at the time.
Well, we went in, as I said, the Navy split up into two groups. One was the aircraft group, and the other was the battleship group.
Mm-hmm.
And one group would go in and do all the bombarding first,
as much as
a month ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered why Iwo Jima never sank, because we threw enough lead in there for it to sink. Anyway,
you didn't know about all the tunnels and caves they had.
But here we are. We're 20 miles away, you see. And after that is when the Marines would go in and land, although we got a little closer because of the anti-aircraft and stuff. But the carriers and the anti-aircraft ships were off to a distance. They weren't that close to the landing.
Sure. And maybe that's better that you didn't have to be closer and see some of the things that people did see there. Now, I do want to save some time to talk a little bit about your coaching exploits and certainly your involvement with the Olympics and some of the things you witnessed in those exploits. But tell me what you remember about when the war came to an end for you, for the country as a whole. I imagine when you're at sea that long and you've seen that much devastation and experienced things that a lot of people your age nowadays will never get to experience. Mm-hmm. What does that do to you? What did it mean to you when you realized this is over, I get to go home?
Well, you know, having been away from home for 3 years, it was something. Things had changed.
Do you remember VJ Day? Do you remember where you were?
Oh, yeah. In fact, VJ Day, we were still fighting after VJ Day. There were still pilots and there were still people on the islands that didn't know the war was over. The war was not over. Even we were in Buckner Bay by Okinawa.
Right.
Planes still came in and hit the Pennsylvania, which was a big battleship.
Right.
One of the ships that was sunk in Pearl Harbor had been restored.
That's right.
It was right next to us, and they got bombed. They got a kamikaze, and there were still people out there even after the war.
Had you guys heard that the surrender had been signed?
Oh, yeah. Well,
so there had been some celebration?
There was a period of time between the end of the war and the signing.
Right.
Yeah, you see. But in that period of time, we had to go out during the day where we were anchored so that we would not get attacked while we're sitting still, you know, dead ducks in Buckner Bay. Buckner was the general that got killed.
Right, right.
Anyway, so we would have to go out because there were still threats even after the war was supposed to be over.
So when did you finally get to breathe and head on home?
Well, it was kind of nice because we went back to Hawaii and we were put up. The chief petty officers were in the Royal Hawaiian Hotel.
Uh-huh.
And the people in charge of recreation at that time was Bobby Riggs, a great tennis player.
Yeah.
And Schoolboy Rowe, who was a great baseball pitcher for Detroit. They were in the Navy and they were in charge of recreation in Hawaii. And that was the best time we had. That was for rest and relaxation after the war.
That sounds like it. I can imagine how that would top the constant gunfire of some of those Pacific battles. So you finally got to come home, and you decided to head back to your native Midwest?
Well, yes. I decided to go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I always wanted to do. So at first, I needed a job, make some money. I immediately got a job in Cleveland High School teaching physical education and coaching track and assistant in football at East High School in Cleveland. I was able to get a job right away. There was no problem. They needed a track coach who had got ill or something, and I was a substitute teacher, but I became a permanent substitute teacher and coach, and I coached for about 3 years at East High School in Cleveland.
So that was the start of it, but that journey was long from finished. We'll take our final break, come back, and get our conclusion today with George Dales. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As usual, the time has gone by way too quickly, but I do want to remind you one more time, head down to the Save Mart Center for the Run for the Dream, the track meet today. Bob Fraley's brainchild is such a great gem for the Central Valley and something that I hope to see continue for years and years, and I know George Dales feels the same way about that. Look him up. Go shake his hand out there today when you make your way to the Save Mart Center. It's been a lot of fun hearing some of his stories from World War II, and before we took that last break, he talked about his transition after the war into coaching, which he has spent the rest of his life doing in one form or another. He won two national championships in cross country at Western Michigan. He's worked in the Olympic Games. He's a legend in the track coaching business. And early on, as you got your start, George, I imagine that there were some lessons you learned during World War II and all the things that you experienced that you were able to implement as a coach?
Yes, I think I really appreciated being fit, for one thing, and being able to survive all the difficulties. And it was really a pleasure to work with young people. And actually, I had done that on board ship. There were some young and quite some old-timers, too. We called them the old salts. But I'd made up my mind that that's what I wanted to do, is work and continue physical education and get into coaching.
And you did that with tremendous success. Do you look back on all your years in coaching and see one thing, and maybe one thing is hard to pick, but that you're most proud of with the way your career played out?
Well, I was very fortunate that I had a young fellow by the name of Ira Murchison who got a gold medal running on the relay team in 1952 Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, 1956 in Australia.
56 in Melbourne.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah. And he broke Jesse Owens' world record after that in Germany. He ran 10-1 three times. Jesse Owens' record was 10-2 on cinders, remember. It's not like these modern tracks.
And, of course, Jesse Owens being an Ohio State guy, for a Western Michigan guy to break his record felt good, too, I'm sure.
Fantastic. You know, Jesse would go around and lecture for the YMCA and for ARCO. Was a great guy. He always came to Kalamazoo in the summer to play golf with one of his buddies.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to know him real well. And Ira Murchison won the NCAA, and he got his gold medal on the relay. He was fourth at the Olympics. And he went on to become track coach at Chicago State in mm-hmm. Chicago. And then the other one was the other world record was Chris Papanikolaou from Greece. Both parents were from Greece, so I knew the language.
I can tell the way you rattled off that pronunciation.
Well, I was called by the State Department that they needed somebody to go over under the Kennedy Foundation where they had specialists going overseas. I was asked if I wanted to go to Greece, and I said, sure, I'll go there and work with the coaches to help train coaches. They were behind, of course, right after the war. And so I got to know a young pole vaulter. During this school year, he came back. They sent him back to train at our place in the wintertime. His name was Chris Papanikolaou. Well, anyway, I gave him the gymnastics training and stuff out at Western. And he was the first person who went 18 feet, broke the world record, after the Mexico Olympics.
Uh-huh.
He was fourth in the Olympics, went back home, and he broke the world record.
Well, I could see where that would be satisfying, especially since you at one time were a top pole vaulter as well. And now, how did you get involved with the U.S. Olympic team?
I was with the Olympic Academy. The Olympic Academy was a historical, philosophical organization that met every summer at Olympia, Greece, and every country would send people there to go through the really it was an institute, orientation, a history of the Olympics and so on. So I got to meet a lot of people that way, and I got to meet the Greek Olympic officials, and they'd asked me to come back and work with their coaches. So I got first involved with the Greek Olympic team.
Mm-hmm.
But then having had that experience, having been a track coach, I was appointed to go at the World Championships. World Junior Championships, where Bob Fraley was the one of the men's coaches. And we were involved with foreign trips and so on. So I was mostly in the educational part of the Olympics. There's a Olympic educational branch where people are trying to maintain of the historical, philosophical, sociological aspects of and the meaning of Olympic sports. So I got involved mostly in that area.
Well, and I know that your reputation around track and field is just the tippy-top shape, and everyone respects what you've done. We only have a couple minutes left in the show, but I've got to ask you, and during the war, obviously there were plenty of close calls, plenty of days where you didn't know if you'd wake up the next day. But I understand that in 1972 in Munich, you were very nearly in that room where this famous terrorist attack occurred.
Yes, I was a vice president of the International Track Coach Association, and my friend was the Israeli coach, Abraham Green. So he invited us over, myself and Gideon Ariel, who was a biomechanist, and a member of the Israeli team previously, 1960 Olympics. They invited us over that evening, because after 4 days of Olympics, there's always a day of rest, and then four more days.
Right.
Well, the fourth day, everybody has kind of a party and so on. So I was invited to the Israeli team, and they said, well, why don't you just stay over? You know, we're going to be late and so on. And I said, no, and my friend and I have already made arrangements to go on a tour to go see the Austrian palaces. So we left that party that evening. Had we stayed, we would have both been involved in that terrorist attack of the Israeli team.
And what a horrible day, and a scar on not just the sports landscape, but our historic landscape. But, wow, I guess that kind of takes your breath away when you look back and see what could have been.
Yeah, yes.
Well, I'm thankful that you made that decision, that you're here to talk with us tonight. Anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners about your time in the war and what it meant to you and how it helped you develop into the man you are today?
Well, I'll tell you, right after you just kind of forgot the war completely for about 20 or 25, even 30 years. And it isn't until just recently with the present wars and so on that the memories come back and you're asked questions and so on and so forth. And we never talked about it too much then, but more and more people are asking questions. And, in fact, yesterday we were at the Air Force
Lemoore Naval Air Station.
Air Base, and two of the boys came over and says, well, my dad was also a chief petty officer in the Navy and wanted to know more about Iwo Jima because he was studying Iwo Jima. So that kind of brings that stuff back and memories and actually brings tears to your eyes. But I'm so glad that I was Secretary Treasurer for the Track Coach Association many years here. I'm president of the International Track Coach Association. So track and field has meant a lot to me and has done a lot for me, and I'm really, really been blessed.
Well, and you've done a lot for track and field, so I want to thank you for serving our country and for serving so well that sport and promoting it throughout your career. And don't stop anytime soon, right?
Yes. I can't stop. You got to be a moving target.
Sounds good to me. On that note, we'll wrap up the program. George Dales has been our guest today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.